Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Morning, it's Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. So the legendary sitcom I Love Lucy turned 65 this week, and as you can imagine, not many associated with this iconic program are still around to tell the story. Lucille Ball, Desi Arnaz, Vivian Vance, and William Frawley are all gone, but the young actor who played Lucy and Ricky's son, Little Ricky, is the last man standing with the memories of being on the set and the relationships he had with the stars of this legendary program. Feels like it was just yesterday, and joining me to celebrate the 65th anniversary of I Love Lucy is Little Ricky himself, and that is Keith Thibodeau. Good morning to you, Keith. So happy you're joining us once again.
Good evening. Nice to be here, Dave, with you.
You know, the days of I Love Lucy are really from an era gone by and so long ago for you. But there are few eyewitnesses left from that series that can really still tell the story. Now, you were born in 1950, 1 year before Lucy even began, and you got your start really when you were 2 and 3 years old. You were playing the drums already.
Yes, I had a curious talent of being able to play the drums when I was very, very young. At the age of 2, I began playing on trash cans in the backyard of our house in Bunky, Louisiana, a little bitty town, and guy named Horace Height, who had a big variety show back in the 50s, who discovered people like Art Carney and Gordon McRae, and had this a Swift Premium Hour. He had a talent show, and I was on it, and I won the talent show. And then a couple of weeks later, we got a call from Mr. Height, my father and I, asking us to join his show as a regular. So about the age of 3 and a half, 4 years old, something like that.
But Keith, you were self-taught. I mean, you were self-taught. This came, you know, this just came naturally to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, it has its pluses and minuses, you know, but it definitely catapulted me to a stage at a very young age.
Yeah.
To be able to play the drums, you know.
Yeah, and you started touring, which was amazing. And then your father took you to the auditions for Little Ricky in 1956 after 200 or so actors already auditioned for the part. You walked in and met Lucille Ball.
Yeah, that was in L.A. and at Desilu Studios, and I walked on the set, and Lucy looked at me and looked at my father and said, "Well, he's cute, but what does he do?" And so my dad said, "Well, he can play the drums." And so they happened to have a set of drums on the set, and so I went over to the drums, started playing, and one thing, you know, came to another. All the workers gathered around here, and all the drum solo going on, and Sheldon Leonard, the big producer who produced the Dandy Thomas show, mm-hmm. and he did a lot of Andy Griffith stuff as well. He came over and was watching, and Desi came over, and Desi Arnaz finally began to play with me on the drums, and then stood up and laughed and said, "Well, folks, I think we found Little Ricky."
That's so fantastic. That's fantastic. Well, I mean, obviously, and you kind of looked like him a little bit, too, which I would assume would help a little bit. And you were so young at the time. I mean, you were 6 years old, and you did it for a little over 4 years until you were 10. What are some of the memories you have working with Lucy and Desi?
Well, you know, I was actually 5 years old to 9 years old, which is, you know, not that much of a difference. But you know, Lucy and Desi were like my family. I mean, they were my Hollywood family, and I really had sort of a split life. I had a life in the Valley, San Fernando Valley, there in California, and then I had a life in Beverly Hills, you know, with the Arnazes, and I was best friends with her children, and I was one of the trusted people that Lucy would have over for playtime with her kids, and we'd watch movies and go bowling and go to the ocean and ride horses and go to Rams football games and Dodger Dodger baseball games and so, yeah.
And Lucy kind of treated you, you know, and I've read this in your book that you did some years ago, that, you know, she treated you like one of the family. What do you remember her best on the set? I mean, was she, you know, Desi was kind of the unsung hero of really the production of mm-hmm. the show. Was Lucy, did you get a sense that Lucy was really in charge of what was going on the set?
Oh, well, she definitely was the diva of the set, and she called a lot of shots, but Desi was it was sort of the brains behind the whole thing. Lucy was more of the star. In fact, she was the star, no doubt about that. And she operated in a way that was very protective toward me because I was the a little child.
You're the kid, so, yeah.
Yeah, so she was. She did her role in that manner and was very protective of me and made sure that none of the the technicians would cuss or whatever around little kid.
Sure. How about working with Vivian Vance and William Frawley?
Well, they were great. I mean, it was definitely a professional set. Lucy expected everyone to be professional. Desi was a little bit more easygoing and more creative in that sense, but Lucy pretty much ran a tight ship, and you were expected to know your lines and present them in the right manner. And Fred and Ethel, or I should say Viv and William Frawley, were great people. I mean, they were professional, they did their job, and like anybody else on the set, and that's what we were in that sort of camaraderie. And even as a kid, Lucy, I remember when I was on the set, Lucy said, don't call me Mrs. Ball, or don't call us by our last name. Everybody's by their first name here. So here I was, this five-year-old kid calling Lucy.
Out of respect, of course, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but I mean, she didn't want me to call her last name,
Yeah,
that's so that was interesting,
It's pretty cool. Now, Bill Frawley, he seems... just by what we know of him, seems so gruff. Yeah, he got along with kids okay? He got along with you all right?
He did. I mean, I had no run-ins with Bill at all. I mean, he was just kind of a how's the world treating you today, Keith, and that kind of guy, and just meeting him, and he was just an old shoe kind of a guy. And there was a little bit of tension between he and Viv, you could tell that. At certain times, but none of that was really exposed in a great way before me.
Yeah. What do you remember about being on the set at the time? Obviously, this was at a time where television production was just developing. What was the earliest recollections you have of being there? I mean, you were a little kid when you started. Do you remember seeing that live audience for the first time? I mean, what are some of the highlights for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was shot in front of a live audience, so there was a definite energy in the air, and even through our rehearsals and dress rehearsals, there was just energy around the whole production that just catapulted everybody and empowered everybody in a way that was very unique. And I look at it like this: it took everybody to make that show. It took the writers, the directors, the cameraman, the makeup people, the stars, of course, to make the Isle of Lucy show what it was. And Isle of Lucy, of course, wouldn't have been anything without Lucy. So she was the centerpiece of the whole thing.
Sure. What were some of your favorite episodes? As a kid, it must have been pretty exciting to see some of these big name stars, walk onto the set.
Yeah, that was exciting. I mean, Maurice Chevalier, there was Ernie Kovacs, George Reeves, who was
Superman yeah.
Back in the 50s, and he was my hero. And as a kid, I tell the story that when I shook hands with him and looked up at him, I thought he was really super,
I bet.
And because that was the little kid in me wanting to believe those things, yet the little actor in me knew better,
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Do you just pinch yourself sometimes realizing you were on the most iconic television program of all time?
Yeah. It's pretty, it's funny because people remind me that I'm Little Ricky. You know, I get that all the time. You know, that I'm Little Ricky. But it's like I forget. You know, and I forget what it was. You know, what this show was. Cause when we were doing the show, nobody really thought that it was going to be, you know, run. You know, 50
all these
years.
Later, yeah,
whatever,
yeah. 6 years.
Whatever it is. You know.
Yeah.
So who would have known? You know, but that's how. That's a testimony to its to the quality and people can really relate to this show.
Well, it's something funny too, because you can watch some of these 50 shows and the content is so dated. Like you can catch, you know, I Love Lucy or Andy Griffith or Dick Van Dyke and the Honeymooners, and they still last. But there's some shows, even as good as Jack Benny was, there's some shows in there that the content and the references are so dated. You know,
yes.
For a younger person watching it, there's just no reference whatsoever.
Exactly. There's no life references that are common to everyone, and it doesn't matter what time or time period, you know. You're going to have these issues, like the Honeymoon, or like Andy Griffith, like I Love Lucy.
Keith, you know, you acted a little bit more after you did I Love Lucy and the Lucy Desi Comedy Hour. You were Ron Howard, Opie's best friend, for years on The Andy Griffith Show.
That's right. That was another amazing show that I was able to be on. I loved being on The Andy Griffith Show. It was, and one of the big reasons was the fact that there were other kids, or another child on the set, that I could play with, so that was a natural thing for me to really like. But just the set was very laid back. There was no live audience, so there was not as much pressure and tension in the air doing the Andy Griffith Show, and it was very much like really Mayberry in a lot of ways. The set was conducted in that kind of way. I mean, you had Southern people doing it, and you know, the makeup artists and these kinds of people, that they'd all gather there with Andy and Don, and they'd sing songs on guitar and play chess and checkers back there. It's very laid back stuff.
That it's something I would imagine as well, just because of the content of the show and how the show was done. But you know, really how Andy Griffith was filmed back then, you know, with the cameras, with no audience, that's really how sitcoms are filmed today. There's very few sitcoms out there that have a laugh track anymore, or have a live audience for that matter.
That have a live audience. Well, yeah, I mean, it works. I guess it works both ways. But, you know, at least the Andy Griffith Show, that format really lent itself to not having a live audience. I mean, it was definitely a classic, you know.
Now, you became friends, pretty good friends with Ron Howard as well, but you were about, what, 3-4 years older than him at the time?
Yes, and I always say that if I would have, if I would have known Ron Howard would have been so famous, I would have been a little bit more friendly to Ron. I hung out with him a little bit more. I mean, he, you know, really, in all reality and truth, he was an amazing kid, just a very unassuming, very nice young kid, and we got along really, really good. He used to ask the writers to write me in a part so he can play with me. And he kind of missed having me on the set. I was actually on about 12 episodes, and I played a continuing part, so to speak. It was a small part, Johnny Paul Jason, and I just thoroughly enjoyed just my time that I spent there. It was fun.
But I would think with kids on this, other kids on the set, when being you're the only kid on the set, that's got to be pretty tough, because at that age, you're going to want to play with other people. So I'm sure he loved having you on the show.
Oh, yeah.
And vice versa.
It was awesome. Yeah. We would play catch. You know, we'd go to the commissary, take breaks to go get a hamburger, and in the next booth would be Dick Van Dyke, Mary Tyler Moore, and, you know, it was just that kind of a deal, you know.
Again, you got to just pinch yourself thinking about all that. Now, you acted a little bit more, but you got back to your musical roots, and you joined the band David and the Giants. Tell me a little bit about that time in your life.
Well, it was my rock and roll part of my life, and you know, I played rock in a rock band for I guess the late 60s, early 70s with a band called David and the Giants, who were a regional rock band that recorded records with Capitol, United Artists, and other recording entities in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and so we played all around. And then at this point in my life, in 1974, I came from a broken family, and that's the reason we moved back to Louisiana from California. And we left California, my mom and brothers and sisters, and you know, it started a downward sort of spiral in my life, which I kind of mentioned in my book, Life After Lucy. I went through clinical depression and suicidal thoughts and just all kind of crazy stuff that, you know, the child star syndrome, so to speak, sort of came upon me in a bad way. And it was at this point that I really began to really cry out for help. And I knew that I wasn't going to last long unless God intervened in my life. And I became a Christian in 1974, and Jesus came into my life. And really, you know, it was because of that encounter with the Lord that my life began to change. And so I began to witness to the guys in the van about Jesus and about Christianity, and that there was more to God than what men had led us to believe. And so eventually that band, David and the Giants, became the Christian,
band.
David,
yeah, yeah.
So we were like pioneers in the late 1977, 1979, starting out as a Christian rock band and then playing through the 80s, you know, in decade. Recorded about 9 albums with them. We recorded in CBS, ABC, Word Records, Murr Records, Benson Company in Nashville, and toured, you know, with them all over the U.S. during the 80s until 1990. And then I felt like God was telling me to put music on the shelf and help my wife with a ballet that had begun.
Well, now, you know, just going back a little bit, you know, you talked about, you know, the first kid child star, really, and going through all that. Then you were in the rock and roll industry. I mean, those two worlds colliding with everything. You know, and again, I read this in your book, too. It's an inspirational story because you really had two completely different lives in both in television as a kid star and then in the music business. And both can be very dangerous, and temptations and drugs and alcohol and all that other good stuff. And you found God, which is amazing enough. And it's just an inspirational story because people can overcome some of these challenges, because everybody's got their own stuff, Keith. I mean, everybody does. And then, you know, you didn't credit one person, though, through this. In 76, you met your wife, Kathy, and that really obviously changed your life as well.
Well, you know, in the Bible it says, he who finds a wife finds a good thing and favor from the Lord. And so I definitely received favor at that point in 1976. And I met my beautiful wife, and she was a ballet dancer who had danced for many years. Well, for a couple of years anyway. She's young. She was 19 at the time when I married her. I married a very young girl, so Rob the Cradle. And I was like 25 years old when I married. But she just really was just loved me for who I was, and wasn't really that enamored by the fact that I was Olive Lucy. But she just, you know, was just there just to hear me, you know, and hear all the junk that I'd come out with. And but I began to tell her about the Lord, and she became a believer in a big way. And then we began to talk, you know, a little bit about her, you know, beginning to dance and use her talents for God in a way that we and David and the Giants had done before as well. And so we both started Ballet Magnificat, which is a dedicated to the glory of God. It's a Christian ballet company that does performances all over the world and internationally and here in the U.S. And that began in 1986. And we've been doing that since that point up until the present time.
Yeah, and you've got classes, and you're in Jackson, Mississippi, by the way, but you have classes, you know, from toddler to, I mean, it's a very big, large, successful organization. You have classes from toddler to adult. You have accredited courses at a local university, you know, accredited by the National Association of the Schools of Dance. You have a professional training company for people that are ready to go pro. And you, of course, you have a touring company, and you've been touring. You were just in Terre Haute this last weekend with a performance. You're going to be in Austin, Texas, and so forth. Now, you know, although the organization is focused on the art of dance, it's designated as a nonprofit organization and a ministry as well. So, you know, doing, you know, well and doing good for the community. I know you also give money back to the community. I mean, it's really quite an impressive organization.
Well, you know, we're very unique, you know, and just about anything I've done, you know, has been unique. You know, like I said, you know, we talked about the Alabusi show and then David and the Giants and now Dalla Magnifica. It's like these were all like sort of pioneering things, and I've been blessed to be able to be part of something like that that's so pioneering yet unique in such a way that people really are curious about it and they really appreciate it. You know, Balla Magnifica, you know, it's funny because, you know, we sometimes call our company and what we do, you know, Balla Magnifica is the ballet for deer hunters and Super Bowl football lovers, you know. It really is. I mean, people like that, they get dragged to the ballet and they said, you know, if I'd have known it would have been like this, I wouldn't have come, you know, dragging my feet, you know. It truly is an amazing sort of a miracle that God has enabled us to be a part of, you know.
Well, I'll tell you, if you want to find out more about Keith or to make a donation to his organization or find out more about their touring schedule, you can go to Ballet Magnificat, and it's M-A-G-N as in Nancy, I-F-I-C-A-T.com. Again, when you look back at this, and then you said people kind of tease you around about, yeah, you were little Ricky and so forth, you must look at those so fondly at those early years on I Love Lucy and getting to work with Andy Griffith and Ron Howard on the Andy Griffith Show. You must pinch yourself that you were even part of such an iconic time in television.
Well, it really is kind of like a dream, you know. It's like, did I really do that, you know? And even when I watch myself on television, it's like, you know, I remember, you know, sometimes what I was thinking at that part of my life and you know, or that time when I was doing the show. And it's surreal. It really is. I mean, to watch and to go back in time and to see this, you know, sort of like a time machine, you know, it's like, But it's all filmed. It's all in living color and
yeah. You know, that's funny.
Black and white. You know.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. But you know, a lot of kids from the late 1950s don't have full talking video of their childhood. So it's nice that that you have that reflection. Yeah.
And our daughter Tara, you know, she was when she was growing up, she was such a big fan of the Al Lucy show. When she was a kid, she still is. You know, but she used to have all the episodes. Used to drive me crazy watching them all the time and. But it's cool to be able to pass it on and for your kids to appreciate, you know, and to see kind of some of the things that you did when you were younger, you know.
Absolutely does. And Keith, you hold really such a special place in television history, and I want to thank you for sharing some of those moments with us tonight.
Thank you, Dave. I really appreciate you letting me be on your show.
All right. It's Dave Plyer on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.